I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. More than a decade ago, the Institute of Medicine issued its groundbreaking report to Air is Human, which found that an estimated 100,000 patients died in American hospitals every year due to medical mistakes that were preventable. While that sounded the alarm, how much progress has been made since then when it comes to the problems of hospital-acquired infections, treatment mistakes, lost records, communication failures, and overworked and sleep-deprived staff? Our guests, Ross Capel and Suzanne Gordon, are all too familiar with these problems. They have co-edited a new book of essays titled First Do Less Harm, Confronting the Inconvenient Problems of Patient Safety. Ross Capel is on the faculty of the Sociology Department in the School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
Also with us is Suzanne Gordon. She's a journalist and also a visiting professor at the University of Maryland School of Nursing, and she's the editor of the Culture and Politics of Healthcare Work series at Cornell University Press. And Suzanne Gordon, it's been many years. Nice to have you back with us
Thank
on Radio
you for
Times
having
as
me.
Well.
Thank you.
Let me begin with you, Suzanne. Is our healthcare system dangerous to our health?
Well, there are a lot of parts of it that are. And one of the reasons why we wrote this book is because we're not only observers but patients, and we've had family members who are patients, and we've experienced our own set of problems with the healthcare system. And over the years, as Ross and I have been talking to each other, we really concluded that there were a whole lot of things that were sort of off the charts when it came to issues of patient safety, even though there seems to be a lot of action. And one of the reasons why there's such a glacial pace in improvements after the IOM report, which is a good 12 years ago, is because of lack of discussion about some of these so-called inconvenient issues.
And why the lack of discussion, Ross?
Well, I think we're looking for magic bullets. So we think that teamwork, if we just say the word, will somehow improve us. We think that HIT, healthcare information technology, will save us. We think that continuing care processes will somehow coordinate care when you leave the hospital and go back home or go to a nursing home. But we don't follow through carefully enough. I think healthcare IT, which is my particular focus, offers tremendous promise. But right now it's I think, grotesquely oversold. It's not as good as it should be. It's clunky. And there are no data standards, so that the idea that all of this information could be coordinated and your doctor could see it at one place is not yet there.
Right. The various
vendors have their own ways of recording blood pressure, of recording vitals, of recording history, and they don't coordinate. And the government has chosen to allow the market to work that up rather than to impose standards, and there are good reasons on either side. But the reality is that it's more of a Tower of Babel than it is a coordinated healthcare system. So the IT that was supposed to save us is not there yet.
Well, and I want to pick up on that, but let me talk to you perhaps even globally, Suzanne. We have a very complex healthcare system. I mean, maybe because healthcare is complex. We can deal with things today that we couldn't do a generation or two ago. You could actually go into the hospital and get some kind of treatment. Is the complexity of our healthcare system one of the reasons for the level of error and mistakes?
I think the complexity is a given. But I think what's happening is we're not dealing with the complexity intelligently. And so we're sort of complexifying the complexity, if you will.
Yes, and, I actually understand what that means, right.
So, you know, people aren't looking at the complexities of the work and saying, what do people need in order to make it safe? So, for example, one of the things we discuss is workload, fatigue, etc. So if you have complexity, at hyper-complexity as you're given, right, do you then want people working in the healthcare system who are working for 12, 15, 16, 80, you know, 12, 15, 16, 24 hours, whatever, when we know that fatigue makes it difficult for you to attend to non-complex things and sometimes often impossible to attend to complex things. We know that the brain now, thanks to brain science, can't multitask. So do we want nurses and doctors, do we want nurses to be taking care of 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 patients and residents and interns to be taking care of 25 patients with all the attendant interruptions if we know that people can't resume task when they're interrupted?
But do we do that because it's cheaper or it's just hard to change tradition or bureaucracy?
Both.
Ross?
Both.
Both?
I mean, a lot of it is a tradition, and there are issues on either side. So if we make shifts shorter, then there's going to be more handoffs. A handoff is an opportunity for a mistake, where you should go from one patient, move the patient from one doctor to the next or one team of nurses to the next. We know also, speaking about what Suzanne was saying about patient safety and time, being up for 24 hours is exactly the equivalent of being legally drunk. We can test that. So this idea that we have to put doctors through this hell of residency comes and bites us back in the proverbial because it makes them less aware of what's going on. The other side of that argument is, of course, that they get to watch the continuum of care of a patient.
So they can't watch if they're asleep.
But you think it's what's interesting though is we have, you know, the threat of medical malpractice lawsuits hanging over the heads of hospitals, doctors, probably nurses as well. Why isn't that enough to kind of force changes in the system if there are these mistakes that are being made?
I think that what you see in systems of, you know, you see it in your own life and you see it in systems, right, that I call it the sort of, there's a trump card always. So, you know, you say you want to lose weight, right, but then you're trumped by, I don't know, the chocolate cake or whatever. And I think that there's a lot of things that are given rhetorical lip service in healthcare, patient safety being one of them. But there's a trump card, which is, you know, profit, institutional survival, status hierarchies, which is a huge thing. And so, I mean, let me give you an example.
Go ahead.
We know that ties, male doctors' ties, are just crawling with germs, right? And you know, picture a doctor leaning over a patient's bed, getting the tie in the patient. These ties are not, you know, sterilized. They're not even washed every time, you know, a doctor goes home and takes it off. We know that it's, you know, that it's clear that ties carry germs. Simple thing, take off your tie.
Right.
Right? Why not? Because the tie is a symbol of the doctor's status. So status trumps safety in this issue, right? We, National Health Service in Britain has a policy, you know, no naked below the elbow, no long nails, no rings, no lab coats, no ties. I mean, it's a lot harder to get germs all over, you know, your scrub, and you know, when you lean in and you touch a patient's bed with your naked arm, you can wash it off. You're not going to take your lab coat off every time. These are, so why not? We know this. We've known it for years.
Well, let me pick up on that, because we have done shows about washing your hands. I mean, there's nothing more basic than washing your hands. But as I understand it, that doesn't necessarily always happen within a medical setting.
Right. And that's directly related to something we talked about before, which is the number of nurses versus the number of patients and the number of doctors. You know, the aging boom, the age hit exactly 65. The baby boom hit exactly 65 January 1 of this year. Going into the hospital is exactly parallel to getting older. We have fewer beds. We have less money available. And as of tomorrow, we may have dramatically less money available.
This is when the Supreme Court decides.
Right. And yet we still have the same requirements of those patients. So if there are more patients and fewer nurses and fewer doctors and fewer resources, the time to wash your hands with every intervention, every time you go into a room to check on a dial, to check one of the wires that leads in that's pulled out as the patient spun over or something, all of that impacts patient safety because there are only so many hours in a day.
Right. Even the 40 seconds that it would take to wash your hands, that seems
like... Yeah, but you have to multiply 40 seconds times, you know, hundreds, because, I mean, it seems like nothing, 40 seconds, right? And it's 40 seconds is is just normal. If you get any bodily fluids or blood on your hands, it's 4 minutes. Right.
Really?
So, oh, yeah. So, I mean, you know, in your own life, it's happy birthday to you twice, right? The normal hand wash.
Yes.
And sometimes they have gels, but the gels leave a film that, you know, after a certain number of times, you have to wash your hands. And so, you know, 40 seconds seems nothing, but if you multiply 40 seconds times hundreds, and I mean, you know, the nurse going in and out, a doctor going in and out, you multiply that, each patient adds, you know, X numbers of hand washes. So, and then, you know, there's also the workers' hands, right? I mean, you can only take so much hand washing on your hands. They crack, they, so, and then, and.
Well, it sounds like, and I want to take this all apart, because, and I want to pick up on IT as well with you, Ross Capel, but it sounds like then we need more doctors and nurses and medical staff. Yes?
Well,
I mean, would that help to solve the problem that we've been talking about?
It would help. So if you watch a nurse's station on a typical shift, there are, and I'm not making this up, about 1,800 alarms going off. All the patients have alarms on their blood pressure, on their heartbeats, on their heart, on all of that, oxygen saturation levels. Very often those alarms go off because somebody spun over and pulled out a wire, because somebody's coughed and it's interpreted. The nurses become very thoughtful about observing which alarms are consequential and which are not. But even to keep that level of attention,
vigilance.
You have to pay attention to which ones you're going to ignore and which ones you're not. So there's no free lunch here. You can't somehow reduce the number of nurses to some minimal number because you've introduced the technology. The technology introduces additional steps. I wrote an article on barcoded medication administration. That's where every patient has a barcode, every medication has a barcode. It was supposed to be this tremendous time saver and this patient safety device. What we found is there were about 31 workarounds that the nurses had to implement. So if the patient has a medication that's refrigerated, you're not going to wheel the patient down 3 flights of stairs to the fridge. You're not going to cut off her arm with the – you're going to take an extra copy of her barcode. And while you do that, you take an extra 4 other patients' barcodes who also have refrigerated medications. And you're going to try to very carefully keep them separated. And I don't have to finish
that. And then somebody crashes and you have to run to a code. And then, you know, you've got these 4 barcodes on you. And, oh, my God, which barcode is which? It's – I mean, I think that workload is just something that a lot of people don't want to deal with because it means spending more money. And, of course, the problem is that there's a lot of short-term thinking in healthcare. And, you know, there's what can we cut now? What can we do now? There's not this long-term thinking about, you know, what are the long-term consequences?
We're going to take a very short break and back to our conversation with Suzanne Gordon and Ross Capel. They've written, or actually, I should say, they've edited a new book called First Do Less Harm, Confronting the Inconvenient Problems of Patient Safety. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The National Multiple Sclerosis Society supports WHYY and announces Bike MS, City to Shore 2012. More than 7,000 cyclists of all ages and abilities will ride from Cherry Hill to Ocean City, New Jersey to help support a world free of MS. This ride is fully supported with catered rest stops, bike support, and SAG transportation. Cyclists can choose from a range of route options. To register, 800-455-BIKE or mscycling.org.
Hey, I'm Jad.
I'm Robert.
We make the show Radiolab.
Which is mostly a show just for your ears.
But not anymore. Because coming soon to the Kimmel Center's Academy of Music...
A very different kind of Radiolab.
Yeah, eyeballs dancing.
Astronauts sizzling.
Holy cow.
Blind men yelling.
Sultan, you are trying to impose a visual totalitarianism upon the human brain.
Join us for Radiolab Live June 29th. Details are at radiolab.org/inthedark.
We are in the thick of wedding season, and while many couples are focused on the big day, financial experts say focusing on financial details is key to a successful marriage.
One of the best things that people can do is be transparent with their finances before they get married, or even if they've just gotten married.
Money Coach Luis Barajas gives financial advice for newlyweds. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Suzanne Gordon and Ross Capel. They've edited a book that looks at patient safety from a wide variety of perspectives, offering some solutions to a solvable problem. The book is called First Do Less Harm, and Ross Capel is on the faculty of the Sociology Department and the School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a sociologist. Suzanne Gordon is a journalist, the author of a number of books, visiting professor at the University of Maryland School of Nursing and editor of the Culture and Politics of Healthcare Work series at Cornell University Press. And we'd love to hear from either patients, healthcare professionals, and staff in the audience at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you think can be done about this particular problem? Ross, let me go back to you and go back to IT. And as you were saying a couple of years ago, the idea of e-medical records, that everything would be, you know, loaded online and doctors could share with each other and nurses could share with doctors and patients would have access. We do this with banking, don't
yes, we?
Why can't we do this with medicine?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, a bank account is easier to keep track of and there's one little number. With medication issues, with all of the various hospital issues, there are different ways of recording that information. And each of the vendors has their own style and their own system. And it's actually in their interest not to cooperate.
Really?
Yeah. And here's why. They want to sell a suite of products. So they want to sell the ordering system called the computerized physician order entry system. They want to sell the electronic medical record. They want to sell the pharmacy IT system. So it's not in their interest to have systems that actually communicate across vendors. And as a result, we all suffer.
Hmm. Well, is that then, I mean, not that this would happen in the United States of America, but the idea of having some one, a kind of a one size fits all?
Well, it did happen. We had, I think at the time of Lincoln, we had about 12 different railroad gauges. And each railroad company said, no, it's got to be ours. It's got to be ours. And Lincoln said, you know, as of Thursday, it's going to be so many feet apart. We had something like 115 time zones in this country. You could leave Cleveland and arrive in Cincinnati before you left, or the other way
really?
Around. I'm from New York. Chicago train station had six local time zone clocks in it. And it was, ironically, it was the railroads who said, this is nuts. And they asked the government, you know, pick time zones. So we face this all over the time. We have it with machine parts. We've picked standards. Right. Ideally, the industry plays nicely in a sandbox and they pick it. And the government simply said, that's it. In our case, the industry is struggling to get market share because the government is now paying doctors and hospitals to buy these IT systems. And so every IT system wants to get their foot in the door and lock in their market position.
And competing with each other and therefore don't have this sort of one-size-fits-all.
Exactly.
And the other thing is that a lot of the IT systems are designed by sort of computer geeks who are wonderful people, no disrespect intended, but they don't know anything about patient care, and they're not asking the frontline users about how to make this easier on them, and they're not even factoring in all kinds of assumptions and so forth. And a lot of times the vendors or the hospitals are using these systems also primarily or a lot for billing information, not for patient care. And there's really not a lot of willingness for on the part of the frontline users, given the fact that they're not designed with them
in mind.
And there's because the hospitals are spending so much millions and millions of dollars on these systems, when somebody comes up and says, excuse me, but you know, this isn't so great, there's not a lot of willingness on the part of the hospitals to say, okay, we want to hear from you. It's like, we don't want to hear from you because we don't want the judgment and the money that we've just, you know, spent to be questioned.
Right. Go ahead, Rob.
So, 2 points on that. One, if a hospital buys one of these very elaborate systems, a mm-hmm. complete suite, that could cost $200 million.
For
one large hospital. Then they have to implement it. And the hospital may have 200 or 300 other IT systems with which this has to connect. And they all have their own sets of drugs and order sets and routines. So that all has to be coordinated. It takes up to 4 to 5 years to implement one of these systems. And so the cost, instead of being just the $200,000, we're now looking at almost $1 billion to implement a complex system. Huh. Once you've done that, you're not about to throw it out and get a better system. And that means that the vendor has you in a position that you can't leave. So when you ask for something, the vendor says, we'll try to get to it. And it's their game. But let me give you an example. So, for instance, there is one system that you have to put in the difference in pupillary response between the left and right eye. Okay? Sounds reasonable. There are millions of people with one eye, and there are millions of people with two eyes, but one doesn't work. What does the doctor put in there?
Oh.
And if he can't go on or she can't go on beyond filling that box in, there's a problem.
The system won't
work. Right. It's called a forest field.
Oh, interesting. Well, and I was just to add to this, I was reading that there are something like 13,000 diagnoses, 6,000 drugs, and something like 4,000 procedures. So just to sort of add to the complexity of the particular system. But at the same time, there are problems with doctor handwriting. I mean, isn't this supposed to solve that particular problem?
It does.
Right.
It solves that problem. Now, sometimes it lists drugs and it truncates parts of the end of the drug in the listing. So instead of having a handwriting problem, you have literally a space, an alphabet problem.
Oh.
Or it lists the drugs as options alphabetically rather than the most common one, and the doctor will pick the wrong one, as we all do from drop-down menus. The systems are not designed to be particularly usable. They're not usable.
Let me turn to you, Suzanne, and talk a little bit about frontline workers. And there are a number of articles or essays in this book about, obviously, the importance of frontline workers. These are the people that deliver the care. But it doesn't sound as if they are seen as important players. You know, they have a lot of knowledge about how the system either works or doesn't work.
Well, one of the thematics of the book is not asking people what they need to do their job safely, because if you say I'm too tired or I have too many patients or I'm interviewing too many guests and I just can't keep up, we need to listen to you, and because most people are not shirkers and they want to do their job well and they know what the problems are and they can be very helpful. And there's a very top-down tendency. It's like toxically hierarchical, unnecessarily authoritarianly hierarchical. And this plays into every single aspect of what we write about. Somebody sees a doctor, somebody of lower status, like a patient or an intern, or somebody sees somebody not washing their hands and they're afraid to say something because, God forbid, the doctor should lose face. That trumps patient safety. And we see the same thing in all these initiatives around patient safety, that they're often designed by outside consultants. They are, sold to management at great expense. Whether it's HIT or some patient safety initiative around teamwork or whatever. And then, upper level management goes to middle management and says, we want champions. And then they go to the frontline staff and they say, we're doing this. We want you to be involved and enthusiastic. And they're like, wait a minute. This doesn't necessarily solve the problem, and so forth.
Well, one of the articles in here, one of the pieces in here says, you know, let's look at the aviation industry and see how pilots and flight attendants and how the system works, and maybe that's something right. that could be appropriated for the healthcare
well,
system.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of discussion about what's called crew resource management, CRM, in healthcare. There's also huge resistance to learning anything from other industries because there's a kind of complexity competition, and doctors and nurses like to think our job is the most complex, and you know it gets to be competitive, like kind of like, you know, Sullenberger when he was landing the plane in the Hudson didn't think, oh, this isn't so bad, I could be a neurosurgeon, you know. I mean,
but you're saying there's too much of that in the health.
Well, yeah, people are like, oh, we can't really learn that much from CRM and aviation or other high reliability industries because our job is so complex, it's so much more complex. Well, I mean, you know, actually a pilot can kill more people in one fell swoop than a doctor can imagine killing in their whole life. But it's a stupid discussion. I mean, the idea is, what can you learn from people in another area of life who deal with stress, who have people depending on their judgment, and when there's a lot of complexity and technology, and we can learn a lot from aviation.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to get some callers in as well. That's Suzanne Gordon, who joins us along with Ross Capel, talking about their book that they have edited, a new book called First Do Less Harm, Confronting the Inconvenient Problems of Patient Safety. Suzanne Gordon is a journalist and Ross Capel is a sociologist. A couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We're talking about patient safety and how to make patients, frankly, safer within our healthcare system. Ross, you wanted to add something, then I want to go to Maria.
The lessons from industry cut both ways. So sometimes we say, look, if we can run a factory, we can run a hospital. And we come up with these ideas for management by smiling. Mm-hmm. So we have the nurses run into every patient's room once an hour to say, hi, we're here to give you excellent care. Why do we do that? Because there's a questionnaire that's sent out when every patient leaves saying, did you receive excellent, good, fair, poor care? So basically, these management consultants are telling the nurses to game the system. But nurses are a scarce resource. I'd really want them attending to the patients who need the care and not trying to game the questionnaire.
Fair enough. Let me get, it looks like Maria from Roxborough to join our conversation. And Maria, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
I've been a doctor for 17 years, a primary care doctor, and we got the electronic medical record 5 years ago, and one of the great advantages is that I get my lab test right away, get the results of the mammogram right away, and it's linked to the patient's chart. And it won't allow you to miss the lab tests, and that's wonderful. And also, if I ask someone to the specialist, I get to read immediately. The specialist sends a note right back. It's like an electronic, or it's like an email saying, hi, I saw your patient, look at my note. We don't expect the patient to do is say, now you tell me, what did your doctor mean by that? Because the burden shouldn't be on patients. So that's an upside.
Okay, that's the upside. What's the downside, Maria?
The downside is the sheer misery of writing notes that were not developed by clinicians. And so in order to, let's say I spend 30 minutes with you, I go 15 minutes over because 15 minutes simply isn't enough. Mm-hmm. We have long discussions about your leg pain. In order for me to be able to bill fairly for that 30 minutes, or even 50 minutes, 15 minutes, I have to make a certain number of clicks. So left leg, leg pain, click, left leg, click, calf, click, and so on. And sometimes the notes take over 100 clicks.
Wow.
And if all those clicks are not in there, someone goes into my note and they knock it down, say, from a level 3 to a level 2.
Well,
and my productivity is measured that way.
Well, Maria, I appreciate the call, and I think you've laid out in vivid description the pros and the cons. Let me give Ross Capel a chance to respond to your call. Thanks, Maria.
Well, you've exactly given the balanced issue. It has tremendous advantages. I'm absolutely in favor of health IT. I think it's a wonderful idea. If it didn't exist, I'd want to invent it. Mm. But you've also pointed out the problems. Not only is it based on a billing model, but also, Maria, as you point out, there's often an absurd number of clicking that has to be done. And sometimes you have to click and scroll for an absurd amount of time to find two pieces of information that should be there and contiguous. So in addition to, you know, clickomania, there's also this inability to see what you need to see sometimes without going through the whole system. It's not arranged in a way that doctors find convenient in many settings.
Maria, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Suzanne, you want
to add something? Another problem, and I'm sure Maria has experienced it. I mean, maybe she hasn't, and she's lucky, but another problem is that what's happening now with the technology is that the technology, and she sort of indicated this, is becoming like another patient that the doctor and nurse has to attend to. So I don't know how many of the listeners out there have experienced this, but mm-hmm. you go to the doctor or nurse practitioner or whatever, and, you know, they're sitting in front of a computer with their eyes glued to the computer, clicking, entering as you're talking. They're not looking at you. You know, they're missing a look on your face when they ask you a question that would prompt a whole other slew of questions. And, you know, basically, the doctor and nurse are being turned into these data entry clerks because they're given, as she said, 15 minutes or whatever, you know, amount of minutes. And they're not adding to the minutes so that you can enter into the computer and focus on the patient. And it's cutting down interaction between the doctor and patient. It's also cutting down interaction between the team. We have all this talk now about teamwork and communication, and so many medical errors and injuries are due to failure in communication between doctor and nurse and pharmacists, et cetera. Well, if you go to hospitals now, you know, instead of everybody being huddled around the nurse's station, the nurses are in the patient's room with their computers. The doctors are in some little cubbyhole with their computers. They never communicate with each other.
But, you know, I'm wondering, what do they do in other countries? I mean, I'm thinking about European, they have a different healthcare system, but nonetheless, do they do a better job than the U.S.?
In many situations, they face the exact same problems. England spent $12.7 billion on their HIT system and threw it out. It's been a catastrophe. Other nations have much easier systems because, just as Maria indicated, the interface is focused on patient care, not on billing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we spend about a third of our healthcare dollars on insurance company overhead and the like. We make fun of Medicare and Medicaid, but they spend about 3% on overhead. Whereas insurance companies have shareholders, they have people there to deny coverage or justify coverage and the like. It's a major chunk of our healthcare dollars.
And adding to not just the cost, but do you think also adding to mistakes that are made?
It adds to mistakes in the sense that doctors are obliged to spend hours on the phone justifying a procedure to somebody who, frankly, is incentivized to deny the procedure and who is not trained in medicine.
Let's take a very short break. We've got a full bank of calls here, so I do want to get back to our callers after this very short break, talking with Suzanne Gordon and Ross Capel. They've edited a new book of fascinating essays. The book is called First Do Less Harm, Confronting the Inconvenient Problems of Patient Safety. And as we all know, patient safety is important in our healthcare system. We also have a very expensive healthcare system, and it's interesting to have this conversation a day before what appears to be a decision on the Affordable Care Act by the U.S. Supreme Court. We have no open lines. Phone number, though, is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Arden Theater supports WHYY and presents Tulip Omania, the musical, at the Arden Theater May 24th through July 1st. From Michael Ogborn, the writer and composer of Cafe Putanesca and Baby Case, comes a new musical that gets high off our financial lows. Before the subprime mortgage crisis, Holland had the tulip bulb bubble. Six strangers in an Amsterdam hash bar recall this seedy story of love, sex, money, and power. Details online at ardentheater.org or 215-922-1122.
On the next Fresh Air, why flying is no fun anymore and may be getting more dangerous. Aviation writer William McGee says airlines' cost-cutting hasn't just added fees and hassles. He says airplane maintenance is being outsourced to foreign companies where some workers can't read manuals for equipment they're working on. His book is Attention All Passengers. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll catch up with the Nuns on the Bus, Catholic Sisters on a 9-state, 28-city tour to draw attention to what the proposed congressional budget would mean for struggling families. Also, an environmental report card on the country's best and worst beaches. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're talking about how to improve patient safety with our guests, Suzanne Gordon and Ross Capel. Let me get Joe from Winfield to join our conversation. And Joe, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I've been working in IT in the 70s and 80s, and a lot of problems that are being brought up here are systems problems that have been solved, worked on by banks and by many of the other industries, and it's nothing new, and there's nothing unique about a lot of those things like billing and other sorts of things that don't involve a lot of, you know, technical analysis. However, for medical-type things, you know, unique medical systems, you get someone who's a systems analyst who's trained in medical area as well as computer area, and what they do is study how the thing works now,
right,
and they try to translate that over into computers. I agree that vendors are not the people to be listening to because they're only there to sell you equipment. They may have right equipment for you, but you have to be the one that determines that, not them.
Well, Joe, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, kind of underscoring, Ross, what you have been saying, which is that we need people that know how medicine works designing these systems.
Well, we do get doctors involved in the design of the systems. The problem is that the underlying focus of the system is billing, and also the communication among systems is such that we don't get the kind of feedback and the kind of continuity that we need.
Oh, fair enough. Suzanne, let me go back to you because there was an interesting article or essay, I should say, in your book about patients. The patients are not customers. That was at least one of the takeaways from this particular article. And I think patients are often told, well, think of yourself as a customer. I mean, that's, you know, customer, and perhaps the customer's always right. I don't know. Why doesn't that work in medicine?
Well, this is a thematic in the whole book, and basically we very, very adamantly don't like the term customer or consumer because if you look at the ethic of the marketplace, the ethic of the marketplace is caveat emptor, buyer beware. The ethic of healthcare is first do no harm. We're saying since you can't do no harm, maybe you could try to do a little less harm.
Right.
But the fact is that, you know, yes, we're all for having more information and patients being involved in decision making and so forth. But I mean, the point is that, you know, when you go into a hospital, I mean, look at this healthcare HIT thing. How on earth can you as a patient have any impact on your care when they've chosen a vendor or a system which is, you know, confusing everybody and, you know, alarming, creating all this alarm fatigue? I mean, you know, in order to protect yourself from medication errors, there's on average one medication error per patient per hospital day for every patient in the country. You can't, I mean, you know, unless you're somebody who knows what the dose is, you know, what the drug is, what the side effects are, and that you're awake, I mean, how do you know? And so we don't feel that the onus should be on the patient to protect themselves and to make themselves safe. And when you turn a patient, someone who bears pain and suffering, that's the why we patient, that's the Latin,
yes,
into a customer who's supposed to, you know, buyer beware, you've really shifted the whole safety imperative of the system, and you sort of outsourced it onto the patient where it does not belong.
Go ahead, Ross, and we'll get back to our callers.
Also, there's a limited amount of that you can do as a patient with that information. So HHS publishes data on morbidity and mortality by hospital. So if I get a heart attack, am I supposed to direct the ambulance by whipping open my computer and doing age-adjusted morbidity rates for my kind of heart attack? I mean, I'm going to go where the ambulance takes me, where my wife can reach me, where my kids can visit me, where my doctor or my insurance company tells me to go. This information idea that somehow that will make us wiser decision makers is ludicrous. And just one more thing. There are signs now in all of the hospital rooms saying, remind your doctor to wash his hands. You know, first of all, half of the patients are in agony and comatose and
it's just not their job, you're saying.
Yeah, and it's ridiculous.
But I guess it does push back against this notion that, you know, doctor knows best, which had its patronizing
absolutely
psychology and or history.
I think it isn't effective in the sense that we have to address the status issues in healthcare. There's a lot of things that doctors and nurses can do to deal with that. Patients are terrified of being considered a difficult patient by challenging doctors and nurses. And, you know, the doctor or nurse can say to the patient, look, you know, you see this sign, ask me if I wash my hands. I want you to, here's why we're doing this. I want you to ask me, and don't worry, we will never be angry if you ask us a question. These are the kinds of things that need to be done to make patients safe, not just to have these little signs all over the place.
Let me get, looks like Deborah from Langhorne to join our conversation. And Deborah, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi
there.
A little bit off the topic of the IT, I'm an emergency room nurse,
okay.
Have been for over 25 years. So both your guests have excellent points, and I will have to say that money is the bottom line. Administration wants, they look about safety, but yet the comments are about money. They don't look to the future about what mistake they're cutting, because it's all about the money. Yet they want great customer, you know, reports. They do. They send out those pieces of paper. They want, you know, a 5 or, you know, the best score you can give after you give patient care. But yet they're cutting our staff and, you know, not looking at long-term mistakes that could possibly happen. They leave, you know, we have actual scripted phrases taped to our phone about how we're supposed to answer the phone. It's about customer service. And I know,
that's interesting.
You know, a lot of people don't think that, but it is. It's about, you know, keeping the customer happy, answering the phone a certain way. I don't even answer the phone anymore because I don't want to be told how to answer a telephone.
Wow. Deborah, hold on one second.
Okay.
No, I'm just saying, only because both of our guests are about ready to jump through the radio. Thanks for calling.
I know that in New Jersey, which is right near here, there was a nurse in a hospital who was actually suspended for not smiling when she was talking on the phone. There are hospitals, because she wouldn't have a smile in her voice, there are hospitals in upstate New York that put mirrors in front of telephones so that the nurse can look in the mirror and smile before she answers or responds to or makes a telephone call. Now, this is money that is being spent on consultants with these cockamamie ideas to hospitals who buy these services for millions of dollars instead of adding staff that could really make the nurse be smiling in her entire soul.
An actual real smile. Deborah, I appreciate the call. Yeah. Ross, you want to add anything to that?
There's another side to this. So one of the chapters in the book is about nurses who have been involved in hurting a patient and giving the wrong medication and the like. And these nurses spend the rest of their lives going, if only I had reread that medication label 3 times. If only I had stopped and done that. Similarly, I've interviewed now literally hundreds upon hundreds of residents and doctors, and every single one of them remembers every mistake that they know they've made.
Do those mistakes get reported, or is that something that's
sometimes
would help?
And sometimes not? Right. Just we couldn't put it in the book because it came out too late. But there was a Department of Health and Human Services report saying that 86% of problems were actually not reported, that when things were reported, the hospital didn't do anything about them, that there wasn't even agreement on what constituted a mistake or an error.
That's true. But in defense, it's terribly complex. So a lot of the mistakes that are made, we never know about, right? patients are very old. They have 5 or 6 comorbidities, other things wrong with them. They're taking up to 14 pills. Bad things happen to them when we do everything right. Good things happen when we screw up. It's often, and this is the majority of the case, we don't know about the mistakes we made. If we leave a hemostat or a sponge in somebody's thoracic cavity, we find it, and we fix that kind of thing. But the vast majority of errors are more nuanced, and we don't know about them. And when we do know about them, as Suzanne indicated, there's a complex chain of involvement and causality that sort of frees us up to say, well, it should have been written twice on the chart or something.
But what you also said, Ross, I didn't want to let that get away, which is that when someone does make a mistake, they feel badly about it.
Gosh.
Oh, it's terrible.
Right.
Whether you're a doctor, a nurse, or anyone sort of along that
They are very, very dedicated and very caring. Let's not lose that point.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the patient safety doctor, Michael Leonard, puts it really well when he says that we have very smart, intelligent, dedicated people working in complex systems that are designed to make them fail. Mm. And I think that we need to focus on, you know, we can be kind of overwhelmed by the complexity. And I think we really need to focus on, okay, what can you do within that complexity that's right? What can you start doing tomorrow that's right? Where are institutions that we can look at that have done things that work? And what is the basically attitude towards mistakes and errors that you need to adopt to make it psychologically safe for people to discuss them in these complex institutions?
Let me get to, looks like Ada from Ardmore to join us on Radio Times. Ada, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Wonderful program as usual. Thank you.
You're welcome.
My question is, how well regulated are these nursing homes? I call them the going-going-gone places where most of the senior citizens are going to wind up. How well are they regulated? Would you choose one of them over being in a hospital? What should the ratio be of nurse to patient, et cetera?
I appreciate the call, Ada.
We really haven't focused on safety in nursing homes, but there's there's a lot of regulation of nursing homes. A lot of it is the wrong regulation, and there's not much, you know, and nursing homes don't have to have, they only have to have like one RN in them. And I mean, basically, the problems of nursing homes are not problems that we have focused on. We do, however, there is something that is happening, and that is that often patients from the hospital, because of cuts and lengths of stay, go into nursing homes where there really aren't a lot of RNs and staff who can handle the complexity of their care, because nursing homes are used both as, in a certain sense, warehouses of the elderly, what she says, going, going, gone, and also for people to recuperate. And they may not be, they often cannot handle the complexity of the kind of cases that they are now given today, because that's not really what they were set up to do. But I mean, I'd hate to spend a lot of time on nursing homes because we really haven't
discussed them. Ada, thanks for calling.
There is a larger issue here, which is tomorrow the Supreme Court
wanted to ask you about that. Go ahead.
Will announce whether the government will or will not support health care in the way it's been and the way it's scheduled to over the next several years. And depending on how the vote goes, the Supreme Court vote, hospitals will face literally billions upon billions of dollars in losses that they were counting on. That plans for patient safety, for instance, accountable care organizations, where a hospital, when it moves somebody to a nursing home, has to keep track of them and has to coordinate the care. That's part of the current law.
The Affordable Care Act.
Yes. So hospitals get rewarded or punished for how things happen after patients leave, and it encourages them to keep the information flow going, to coordinate care, to make sure that all of the information is passed and passed back. And hospitals now get penalized if patients have to come back for the same problem that they were discharged for within 30 days. All of that may disappear. And so no matter what your feelings are about the law, there will be profound patient safety implications.
Yes. Well, and this is, again, a kind of a global question, and of course we don't know what the Supreme Court is going to decide, but would you say the Affordable Care Act has helped patient safety, or there's no way to evaluate that?
Well, I mean, I have a lot of problems with the law, but there are significant patient safety things in the law that were very valuable. I mean, there's a lot of clinics that have been funded in the community that encourage health promotion and prevention. There's a lot of parts of the law that will impact patient safety. And so I just think we need to be very aware. I mean, for example, if hospitals are going to lose billions of dollars, the first people they cut are nurses. And there's already discussion of that. So if you cut nursing staff, what's going to happen to patient safety? I mean, nurses are the front line of patient safety in a hospital, not actually physicians. So we just have to be aware. And, I mean, it's going to add to the complexity and, in a sense, the hysteria that and create much more chaos in an already chaotically complexified system.
Well, I have to say, we have about a minute before we have to say goodbye here, and I'm feeling thoroughly depressed. I have to tell you that. No, I am.
So,
go ahead.
Okay, so
help me.
First of all, we'll also lose a lot of research funding, which is tragic all the way around, but there are things you can do as a patient. So you can keep track of all of your medications, and I would put them on a massive board behind my headbed. I'd try to have somebody in the hospital with me who knew an advocate who knew what was going on and who questioned, excuse me, yesterday it was a blue pill, today it's red, is that the right pill? I'd have I'd write on my forehead my name. And remember that bit about signing the part of the body you're going to operate on?
Yes.
Actually, you want to sign the other parts and say not here.
Really?
Yeah.
And
you think about it.
And you want to look at, I think if we're providers, you know, for hospitals and nurses and doctors, you want to look at places that have done good things right. You know, here in Pennsylvania, there is a lot of teamwork going on at HUP. Maimonides Hospital in Brooklyn, New York is a real example of how they've involved frontline staff and patient safety. So there are a lot of things that we can do. And the purpose of this book is to encourage people to think not only about the problems, but about the solutions.
Well, Suzanne Gordon and Ross Capel, thanks for joining us. The book is First Do Less Harm, Confronting the Inconvenient Problems of Patient Safety. Go to whyy.org/radiotime to learn more about this program. Our interns are Jared Rausch and Michaela Cross, Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Bilder. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for those phone calls as well.